Group meeting, Sunday, 19th May, 1985. The question arises, towards what is he growing? Nature has dealt with the evolution of the organism, the psychophysical organism as such. And it is nature, more or less, coupled with intelligent care from childhood onwards, that the physical body is brought to maturity. To bring the psyche to maturity, to release the powers of the mind to see truth directly and live intelligently in the light of that seeing is man's responsibility. And it is a tremendous responsibility. In this process, his consciousness is evolving slowly, very, very slowly. It'll take thousands and thousands of years out of its limited, finite, isolative, and separative mode of functioning into a holistic mode of functioning, in which he will be aware of not merely himself as a separate being, but as part and parcel of all humanity at least. He will be sensitive, that means, to humanity as a whole all the time. And at the same time, of course, maintain his personal self-consciousness. Because if you're not awake, properly awake, in the ordinary state of self-consciousness, well, one is very liable to collide with a bus, partly to the detriment of the bus, but very much to the detriment of oneself. So it is this evolution of consciousness which is the most important aspect of our human evolution as such. And the evolution of the, and the culmination of our, of the evolution of our consciousness to the holistic state means essentially living the religious life. Religious not in the common garden limited sense of observing rituals and systems of worship and so forth. All of them can be helpful, undoubtedly, because some temperaments are like that, and they need that, so it is good for them. But religious in the sense of becoming wide awake to reality, to the truth of things, which implies an immense amount of work. The complete purification of the intellectual part of our being, the perceiving part, to get it free of bias, prejudice, preconception, and assumption, and so forth. You see, that is the intellectual part. The other part, the feeling part, is the moral part, that which touches the heart, what we call the virtues, the virtues which specifically distinguish a human being from all other animals, as such. So now, wheresoever and whensoever man's religious nature is thwarted, either because of his own negligence and lack of diligence, or by external circumstance and the flaws in his upbringing and education, whenever his religious nature is thwarted, he is ill, he is miserable, and on the downward path, and every aspect of his total life bears the scars of this thwarting. Now, as a matter of fact, in our own day and age now, this is becoming more and more noticeable. Fortunately, at the same time, there is also this fact to be kept in mind. Namely, that more and more people becoming aware of the ills that are besetting humanity are becoming more inclined to consider the deep things, the things that matter, in the real sense that matter, not merely the ephemeral things, but those things which are concerned with the infinite and the eternal. The present situation is charged with an urgency, poignant and dangerous. No one need expound the poignancy and the urgency of the present material and physical situation. We all know all about that. The lack of true communion between man and man, the new conception of the nature of things and the control of power of undreamed of magnitude, and the serious threat to survival, more because of the decline in living the holy life than the possible misuse of nuclear or some similar power, all cry out for a reassessment of relationships, values, goals, and ways of life. Taking mankind as a whole, the human race more or less pursues the acquisition of wealth, power sometimes, status, and pleasure. That's universal, so to say. Little realizing that their conception of happiness as sensational delights and pleasure are the real guarantee of future misery, in terms not only of physical illness, but of psychical malaise. The majority of people, apathetic and incompetent, will tend to stay in their ruts, going through the motions of formal religion. But those who are not idle and fearful, who honestly direct every energy to understanding religious truth for themselves in their own way, will see that a true reappraisal is possible only if the heart of religion is a glowing reality throughout their whole lives. All over the world there are many people who go to church, say their prayers, observe the laid down rules, and feel satisfied that they have done their religious duty as such, and then carry on just like the ordinary economic, social, political animal. And unfortunately, unlike the animal who is naturally in harmony with the laws of his own being as determined by his own constitution, man alone can be a downright beast, as no animal can. It is well known that he is the greatest predator in the world and has been for centuries, with all his progress, so-called, and development. It is his intellect and his increasing grasp over the powers of nature which have made him like this. Because his moral side, his humane side, has never been attended to sufficiently. And this is what the great teachers, the founders of religions, as well as the truly spiritual teachers of the world, have tried to do. They have bent all their energy, all their power, in trying to put before man, to persuade man to live the truly human life, which essentially means the everyday secular life in a religious manner, in the spirit of religion animating the whole of the secular life. And that alone is really religious living. To put it in an even shorter sentence, the whole of religion is comprised in virtuous living. And the word virtue there has a very wide, a very deep, and a very profound meaning. It's not merely what we understand as the good qualities. We talk about the good qualities, we think we know them, we define them. To be kind means this, that, and the other. To be truthful means this, that, and the other. But if they were really attentive, paid attention to their whole living process throughout the day, they will discover throughout their whole life how limited was their understanding of what they thought they knew as virtue. I'm speaking out of my own living experience. I thought I was a very good chap when I was a little fellow. But I discovered a great deal. And the adverb and the adjective were scratched out. Very and good. Today's human problem is less a problem of doing and much more a problem of being. All the world, particularly the Western world, and this is not to be unkindly critical of the Western world, but the Western world is absolutely enamored of doing. What do we do about it, etc., all the time? What is the nub of the matter and so on? It is matter and doing which has absolutely hypnotized the Western mind. It is unfortunately beginning to hypnotize the Eastern mind too, due considerably to its contact with the West and all the developments in Western technology and so forth. Now this doing is of much less importance than being. You will do that which you are. If I am a robber, a murderer by nature, that's what I'll do. Being that, I'll do that. So the problem really is to change our being, what we are as we are. So many people say glibly, oh, you can't change human nature. Human nature is what it is. They just don't know what they are talking about. In fact, they are talking utterly stupidly. Human nature is one of the most changeable things in the world. By human nature, they mean subhuman nature, for we are not at the human stage as a whole as yet. He who has realized holistic consciousness is the full-fledged human. Not till then. Until then, we are on the way. We are at sub-stages. You see? And the sooner we can see that, the better it will be for all of us. Then the real healing can take place. If I don't acknowledge that bodily I have some illness or disease or pain or whatever it is, you see, I shall never even start thinking of seeking a doctor to heal me. Isn't that so? So if man remains blind to himself and what he actually is in his being, all else will be just useless. Waste of time, energy, expense, and all the rest of it. Man's problem is less of activity and more of rest. That means to be quiet, to be at peace. If one is quiet and peaceful, then all your activity is a quiet and a peaceful state, actually. It is beautiful. You see, this is where beauty comes in the real sense. Be at peace within yourself, in the psyche, and what the body will do, that which the psyche is, and what it does then will be beautiful, essentially. Because the body, all that the body does is the appearance, the shape. What is it that attracts us with anything physical? Oh, that's lovely, isn't it? That's what we say. Look at your engine driver, who is, or your person who has a really nice car. What does he say about her, about the engine or the car? Isn't she a beauty? That's the phrase he uses. Isn't she a beauty? You see? It's like that. It is therefore less of activity and more of rest, peacefulness. Less of the sound and fury of achievement and expansion, and much more of silence. Look how urban life, particularly throughout the world, has become intolerably noisy. To live in a big city is something awful nowadays, on the whole. So it's a case of letting the silence permeate our whole being. And that silence permeates our whole being only if we are rightly watchful with regard to the noise. Not merely the external noise, but the internal noise that goes on inside one's head all the time. The endless chatter. And when it bursts out in what can never be described as conversation, it really is a plague. Far more important than freedom from poverty, disease, and other worldly troubles is freedom from worldliness, which essentially implies freedom from greed, hate, delusion, and aggressive egoism. Freedom from lack of self-knowledge and freedom from ignorance of the reality of the transcendent and the ways for its realization here now. Most people have inwardly in themselves, they may not acknowledge it, but inside themselves, they use the word God or transcendence or whatever it is, but it has no real significance for them. It has insufficient meaning, and therefore meaning in the deep sense of an energy which can be active constructively and happily. See, so in that situation man remains sub-man. Imperatively, man's problem is to abjure the pursuit of wealth and power. Always, always, without exception, a lunatic and criminal pursuit when premature. All the world is avaricious. And it's rather interesting that as far back as 25 and 30 centuries ago, people knew about that. You will find it in the Buddhist scriptures, you'll find it in the Upanishadic and Hindu scriptures, and in the Zarathustrian writings too. And in so one has to abjure the pursuit of wealth and power. If the wealth is there, well and good. Don't throw it away. Don't misuse it. Use it as a trustee for the welfare, not only of yourself and family, but for the whole community. You know, this was one of the great things which underlined the Hindu caste system. The Vaishya caste, the third, the merchant class, you see, it was their bounden duty socially and religiously to make wealth. They are exhorted to make wealth and use it not only for themselves and their families, but for the whole community as and when required. And there are examples of this in actual practice, in the way some of quite a few of the great kings who flourished in the old days used their wealth. You know, centuries ago, I'm talking of at least 10, at least 15, and 20 or 25 centuries ago, the wealth of the sovereign was his granary. And in India, time and again, there would be famine. And the granaries of the king were thrown open to the people. These are historical facts, you see. In the reign of Harshavardhana particularly, this has been recorded not by Indian writers, but by Chinese travelers and others, you see. And Harshavardhana was a contemporary of Muhammad on the one hand, the Prophet Muhammad, and I think it was Li Shi Min in China, who founded the Tang dynasty. Am I right? Did Li Shi Min flourish in the 6th and 7th centuries? He was the great king. Yes, and the histories of Harsha and I think it was Li Shi Min are very similar. They were 16 when by conquest they became masters of the whole country. And they were somewhat similar in character, and they more or less died at the same time, including Muhammad. He died in 632. That's it. You see? So now, if wealth is yours, utilize it rightly, as a trustee, and you will find extraordinary happiness, as inconsequence. I have myself known several wealthy Parsis and Hindus also, who, having used their wealth rightly, were very, very happy people. So abjure the pursuit of wealth and power, and instead grow in love and wisdom, and develop the skills to express them in perfection. Until such love and wisdom have flowered, wealth and power will inevitably be misused and plunge man into sin and suffering. We all know how within our own lifetime we have seen the misuse of power. Mussolini, Hitler, and the whole Jingbeng lot of them, you see. How may the pure flame of religion be rekindled today? There are missionaries all over the world who devote themselves to the propagation of the particular faith to which they belong. But no local culture of the past, no formal garb of the existing great religions, Christian, Buddhist, Hindu, or any other, can effectively meet today's world need. We must never forget that the great world religions have arisen as the spiritual response to the critical needs of the time when the teacher flourished. You look at history carefully. In the time of the Buddha, consider the state of India. In the time of the of Zarathustra, consider the state of Iran and so forth. The difficulties, the troubles, the misery and the unhappiness prevailing. And they arose as the spiritual response to the mistaken way of life. I have always said that the great teachers were the true socialists, the transcendental socialists, because they had holistic consciousness. They were conscious not in terms merely of you and I, but in terms of all humanity. The Buddha's life is one of the most remarkable examples of that. So too the life of Jesus. They made the response in their own day and age, their own circumstance, their own cultural heritage, and so on. All that is different today. So today's response necessarily has to be different accordingly. There are many liberal spirits who work for the unification of all religions. This is a truly short-sighted view. You can't produce a syncretist or an eclectic universal religion for all humanity, simply because humanity consists of several groups, each of which is unique in its own way, as regards its own characteristics and as regards the situation and the circumstances in which it flourishes. So, trying to produce a universal religion might be compared to producing a universal symphony by taking bits out of all the composers and putting the bits together. You can't do it. We can easily see that point and see how ridiculous it is. But these spirits who work for the unification of religions, they are very earnest and sincere people, but rather short-sighted. and with big egos, especially the militant evangelists. I know the truth. All right, I'm not going to contradict you. I'm not going to agree with you either. But then you say, you've got to follow my truth. And he catches me by the scruff of my neck, nearly squeezes the life out of me, and says, do this or you'll go to hell. I'd prefer to go to hell. There are well-intentioned good persons around whom grow new cults and whose adherents believe that they have the panacea for the world's ills. I've come across half a dozen of them in India particularly, and some here too. But they will not provide the bread of life, for their philosophies and theories and the practical disciplines they recommend are like alluring shallows detracting one from the midstream course of meaningful living. One of the profoundest errors, I was going to say, can an error be profound? One of the most dreadful errors that well-meaning people have made is to try to hold out a carrot to the subhuman donkey with their particular theory. You come and join our group. We will, in 6 months, teach you how to levitate. We will show you the way to nirvana, instant nirvana, you see, like instant Nescafe or some such. Some of them are well-meaning and sincere, but the very fact that they are well-meaning and sincere makes me wonder whether they are not remarkably idiotic. Because you can combine well-meaningness and very great sincerity with utter stupidity. Only yesterday, a whole family, nice-looking people, father, mother, and the little children, you see, they all came along to the front door and knocked. I won't mention the group, but I think most of you will guess who. And the lady started talking. So I smiled as sweetly as I could to her and said, thank you very much, but I know all about these groups. Please don't worry us with this. And they were very, very courteous. They went away quietly. None of the above can make the needed response to the unique present. People don't realize that every stage in history is a unique stage. That response which would rekindle the pure flame of religion today could come only from those who have themselves realized the transcendent. In some measure or other, transcendence has to touch the person. And that person can be the living influence to rekindle the flame of religion. Of religion in itself, not a religion. The founders of the great religions of the past were such men. All of them, Krishna, Zarathustra, Buddha, Christ, announced a second advent. Certainly a teacher appears again and again, but never as a repetition of a past form. Never. because that past form was a creative fulfillment for that particular living situation. Never again will Krishna, Zarathustra or Jesus come back as persons recognizable as or even faintly resembling Krishna or Jesus or Zarathustra or Gautama the Buddha. Because the movement of the spirit is non-repetitive, invariably unique in every manifestation of its single essence. You see, one of the difficulties in understanding a statement like that is just this. People are unaware that there is this transcendent context of the infinite, the eternal, which completely subsumes our limited context of the finite and the temporal. And every creative renewal which takes place has the energy for it, has as its source the infinite eternal, the immortal, the primordial, undifferentiated creative energy itself. That is the source. And it never plays the same game over and over again. It's not like arranging the furniture in the room and then arranging it in a different way. It is a new creation every time. And this new creation goes on continuously. Continuously is a bad word in the context of of the infinite and the eternal, but that's the difficulty with language. This goes on all the time. There again, time. I'm sorry, but one can't help that. People are quite unawake to that fact, that the infinite eternal is perpetually active. We don't see its activity because we can't see its activity. We, by virtue of our constitution, are confined to the finite and the temporal. If and when, as and when, heart and mind, intellect and feeling, the whole of the psyche is completely transformed, completely purified, then this transcendent energy, which we commonly call mind, pure mind, can begin to function through our psyche especially and our psychophysical organism as a whole. Then all our thinking, feeling, speaking, doing will be sheer beauty and perfection in itself. Now this is not easy to see, I'll admit that, but if one cares, one can become responsive to it, and then there'll be no problem of seeing it. You will never see it in the ordinary intellectual way, as a logical structure of concepts and words. No, not that way. It will be something which is invisible, which is silent. But it will make this psychophysical organism, which belongs to the material world, to the finite world, the mortal world, it will so inspire this that it will do all that is needful within its own context. And what it does will be perfect beauty. That is yoga in the real sense. Beware of the carrots held out for the practice of yoga. You'll develop wonderful powers, you'll become clairvoyant, you'll do this, you'll do the other. Be careful. Those who pursue yoga that way will probably become quite nutty. I have seen a good many like that. I've seen several in India. The teacher of today will draw afresh from the timeless spring of truth, and he will fill a new cup fashioned by the need of the new world age. Whoso has the heart to lift the cup to his burning lips will be healed and then only live. Live as a true human being. Are the earnest ones then to light their candles and search for the world teacher? Are they to watch for the new dawn when a world savior will come from on high and give a world teaching upon which as a foundation will be constructed the edifice of a world religion? Great teachers inspire and transform their devotees by the influence of their living presence. This presence is a silence. This influence is formless and unconditioned. It is not measurable. It is an immeasurable influence. That doesn't mean it is a power which overwhelms you or compels you. No. It is a power which, strange to say, allows you. That is the astonishing thing about transcendence, about God, or whatever word you like to use. You are allowed. If one can really sort of sense this, become conscious of it, one will begin to feel the thrill of the transcendent nature of the love, the wisdom, the beauty, the goodness of the Supreme. This, to the light of reality, the living presence awakens the sleeper in the dark. The dark whose substance is thought and speech. When you respond to transcendence, all the philosophies, all the theories go out of the window. And yet, those very philosophies and theories can now be truly understood by you. The word of Scripture comes to life, only when you no longer need the word of Scripture. But then it is set aflame, and you see the marvel of it. This is the astonishing thing. The responsibility is a personal responsibility with us. So, what did I say? The living presence awakens the sleeper in the dark whose substance is thought and speech, whose drive proceeds from the egoistic misconception of self, whose binding power is the burdensome conditioning by the past and by environment. Of necessity, the perfected Holy One must speak to his listeners, because there are a few people, one here, one there, maybe several people close by, as for instance with the Buddha. He had the largest number of followers of all the world teachers during their lifetime. No one had so many followers. And therefore, the perfected Holy One must speak to them because they ask him to. The words are treasured. The words continue through time. Commentaries are written, and conflicting interpretations lead to fierce argument and then to war. And so, for the simple souls who hunger and thirst, there is but stale bread and sour wine. Formal religion is fossilized religion. The church and the temple and the sacred tomes and the postures of piety may thrill and elevate and comfort and entrance, yet all too often They are monumental impediments to truth. Because the truth is something which is alive and not the fossilized expressions. They cover the living heart of religion with a vast rubble heap of illusions, mere pieces of death. Leaving death to the dead, let the true man go to the living heart. This is one of the keynotes for today, that each man shall individually search out the living heart of his own free will and in his own way. Your way, your real way, is through your own organism, your own psychophysical being. The body is the way. And by body I don't mean merely the physical structure. Body as a whole has a profound meaning. Your body is the way. Consciousness is the traveler. And your body is unique, and your consciousness is also unique. It is transcendence itself in you, and transcendence, being infinite and eternal, is ever creatively new. Unquestioning acceptance of authoritarian teaching marks the impotent. Let there be unceasing, vigilant investigation of that which is. So shall each man see the truth. One has to see it for oneself. If you have a little gift for painting, you are not going to be a painter who has contributed anything of real worth to art or to the world or to your community. If you merely paint a picture which has already been painted. One of the in the world of music, for instance, one of the things which is so praised in the 9 symphonies of Beethoven is that each symphony is completely different from the other. No one wrote quite like that. The newness has the stamp of transcendence in it. Utterly different. From symphonies 1 to 9, what a difference. It's like that. That wonderful arc in human history, extending over 2 millennia, which saw the emergence of the founders of the great religions, each in his own sphere, will not repeat its old shape. The mechanical repetition of an expended pattern would prove only a monotony. Life discards the obsolete. Renewal is rebirth. There is no other rebirth. Therefore, the world will not witness the rise of a new world-embracing religion and the establishment of a worldwide church which will either oust or absorb all other religious organizations. Nor will it see any existing religion do so, despite all militant evangelism, an activity which characterizes the immature. A religious totalitarianism may prove an even greater evil than any of the secular ones. Notice how the totalitarian element in the existing religions of the world have led to terrible discord and misery between the nations. This does not mean that the day of the Holy Ones is over. They have appeared through the ages and will continue to appear whether they are recognized or not. As in all past instances, whatever the Holy One of today or tomorrow will teach will be the expression of his individual realization of the truth. The truth is the spirit parent of the word of all the great teachers. In him who keeps the word, which means in him who lives the holy life, there arises the stainless vision of the truth. He enters into the measureless communion, which is the realization of the transcendent. He is the living word. What such realization means and what is involved in such realization is at the very heart of all religion. It is the main theme of this book.